When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast of board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 493, Top 100 Games of All Time, number 80 to number 71. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode, but especially our new Patreon backer, Nick. Thanks so much, Nick. You rock. All right, friends, we are back, and of course, we are continuing through the top 100 games of all time as universally decided by Board Game Anonymous. We've done it, Anthony. It's done. It's here. Number 80 through number 71.
All right. Yes. It's funny because this is the part of the top 100 when I do it myself where I'm like, wait, where am I? What number is it? Not that these are bad games, but the numbers themselves.
Yes.
They're in the 70s. I don't know. Once you get below 50, it's like boom, boom, boom. But like 70s and 60s. Where are we again?
This batch of 10 has a certain vibe for me.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it. I was just like, oh, I don't know how this happened, but these are mostly, and we'll talk about it second, of course, but like it just somehow gelled together. These fit really well for me. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Not a lot of like, it's got a certain vibe. I'll just leave it at that for the moment.
Yeah, I could see that. Mine does not. Mine's all over the place. So this week, it's pretty random. Which honestly, when I get into like the 70s, that often is what happens.
It's
like,
sure,
these are games that used to be higher and have dropped because I don't play them. Plus some new stuff that isn't high enough yet. Plus some other stuff that's always been in the middle.
Sure.
It's like a weird mishmash.
Yeah, this is more along lines of my like traditional gotta be in the list essential games, mm-hmm, and some oddities here and there, but like kind of like historical essential games. So it's a really exciting list. And again, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being here on this episode, whether you're listening on your podcast player or YouTube. And again, everyone who jumped onto the YouTube train and subscribed and liked, thank you so much. We're at 887 as we speak. We still really want to hit 1,000 before we hit our 500th birthday, so to speak. So if you haven't already, please go to YouTube and subscribe to Board Gamers Anonymous. The podcast is there each and every week. And amongst a number of the videos, Anthony, you put some videos up there recently?
Yeah. So there are a couple of videos that we just added from the Long Island Tabletop Gaming Expo from the spring. And if you're on the Patreon, you would have already heard these episodes as bonus podcasts back in like May, June. But I was finally able to cut my way through the red tape of Adobe Premiere and get those videos up and running. And you can watch the whole thing now. You can see the entire presentation and panel from then, along with the panels from the previous year and all of our presentations from Board Game Academics Conference over the summer. There's a lot of content up there now. So just go to Board Gamers Anonymous on YouTube. Look at the Board Game Academics channel. Kind of stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, a lot of great stuff there and always producing more content. Please let us know what you're looking to see so that we can get that stuff out there. We're going to up the stakes a little bit. We talked about 10 games to give out to the people that were able to subscribe on YouTube. We're going to move that. I think we had, what was it? We had one person. We had one big game going out.
Yeah, you were going to give away one game when we hit 1,000.
Huge game.
Yeah.
So now we're going to do 10. The question is, how do we ship that? Because shipping games is as expensive, if not more expensive. So that's kind of our limit as far as finances are concerned, because, you know, hey, podcast. But we're going to do 10. We're going to figure out how to get these out to people. But again, if you haven't, please, would love to hit a straight 1,000 for the 500th episode. For everyone out there who's already done it, thank you so much. So many people have left different reviews at all different podcast players. Thank you. It means and makes a big difference out there. And of course, our new Patreon backer, Nick. Please, if you haven't already, join patreon.com/BGA. There's always a lot of good stuff out there as well. And it's a great way to support the podcast, especially these days, which, you know, are very, very challenging. And after 11 years, even more so. So again, thank you all for your support, listening, reviewing, recommending, sharing, and subscribing. All right, Anthony, with that said, let's get on to the episode. So why don't you start us off with your number 80?
All right. So we talked about this the last couple of weeks because you kept bringing in smaller games.
I did. They were tiny. And
yeah. And last week in particular, I had like just a bunch of big stuff. I was like, here's Lisboa, here's Barrage, here's Dominant Species Marine. Big game, big game, big game. So this week, and it's not reactive because I already made this list, but this week I'm starting off with something smaller. And this is a two-player game. Just a very quirky, weird little thing from Asmodee that came out in 2021 during COVID. So I don't even know why I got it. I didn't have anybody to play it with at the time, but I've since played it a bunch. And that is Botanic. So this is designed by Frank Critton, Gregoire Larger, and Sebastian Pachon. And it is a two-player game of building out a network of pipes and various bits and pieces to grow these flowers. It's weird. It's a weird looking game.
It's a very weird looking game.
It's weird as heck, and it's weird playing, and I love that. It's just such a amazingly quirky thing. Like the artwork by Franck Dion is, it's just weird, right? If like this funky looking scientist with four arms on the cover, growing plants and like tweaking pipes. At the end of the day, it is you're drafting tiles from a center board and placing them into your personal tableau, and you're trying to maximize your points by creating different connections on this tableau and getting these different flowers that pop up, right? And that's it. That's what you're doing. But how you get there is what makes the game so compelling, right? Like, the draft is not a straight draft. Like, you're pulling tiles from the center row, and then they go into these different sides where you have access to them, and you can place them back onto the center row to, like, cover something up or uncover something else. Like, there's a whole metagame just within, like, how you manage that center row and the draft. And then any tile-laying tableau builder is fantastic because it's just puzzle built in right there. Mm-hmm. So it instantly became one of my favorite two-player games. I drag it around with me when I travel now. And it's just a fun, quirky little good time. And every time I bring it out with the new player, they're like, wow, this looks weird. I'm like, right? And sometimes they're like, yeah. And sometimes they're like, yeah. And then we're friends. So Botanic, it's a great little two-player puzzle game. And it's still available everywhere, too. It looks like something that should have gone out of print and disappeared. But yes, you can still find it. So that's good, at least.
I'm one of those people who said, yeah, because it looked kind of crazy and wacky with the artwork. And it is a sight to be seen. But it's a really fun game, a really smart game. And the artwork is not bad. It's just different and unique and funky, and I'm into it.
Yeah, I mean, that sold it on me at first. I'm like, oh, that looks really weird and different. I'm going to get that. Oh, the game's great, too. Awesome.
That was always a good bonus.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, my number 80. Anthony, you talked about small games last week. I'm bringing a big one here for you. Antiquity. From 2004, from our friends at Splatterspellen. This is super crunch. This is the crunchiest crunch that has ever been crunched in a Euro game. 4.32 on Board Game Geek. And it's all about going way back to Italy in the late Middle Ages. And you are building out your city while in competition with the other cities that are building out around you. So you are in economic competition, and in a very unique way, you have these really interesting module boards that have a lot of different area land masses on each of the different hexes of these large hex boards. And you have to manage your city state on this board as you're dealing with, you know, gaining resources and producing pollution. Again, you wouldn't think about that, but it really works here. And it works as a way to attack other players and kind of block them out of areas of opportunity. And in the city state itself, you're able to build up your own city with different resources, and you have workers. And here's the weird kind of twist. Workers die, and you have to bury them in the graveyard. And you have a special ability, and you have special things that come along with your particular city state. It's such an interesting, unique oddity of a game, and an endless number of chits. Like, the number of small, little, tiny pieces of cardboard that you have to move in here is, like, it's got to be up there in the top five, not including war games, but it's got to be up there at the very least. It should not work. It should be too crunchy. It should be problematic. It should be messy as all get out, and there's an elegance to it. And again, very surprised and really, you know, just thrilled to have an opportunity to play this game. Antiquity from 2004.
It's funny, literally the opposite direction that I went. Antiquity is, I love this game, but I actually got rid of my copy at a certain point
because
of, like you mentioned, the crunchy, crunchy, crunchy.
Yeah.
It just didn't get played, and then Splatter has a certain feel to it.
Sure.
So I 100% agree, and I had it on my list at one point, and it's only fallen off because did not get played like the other Splatters do. For me, personally. I think
understood.
It's amazing, though.
Yeah.
All right. Number 79 on my list is a game that came out back in 2019. I picked it up at Gen Con. And I played it a whole bunch. It was getting to the table pretty regularly up until, for obvious reasons, in 2020. We no longer play it. That's Black Angel. And this is the sci-fi reinterpretation of Toi. Which was a game about kind of French Renaissance, not even Renaissance, medieval ages. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of a similar idea, but with a lot of different mechanics going on, but the same designers, so iterating on their own design, but in space. And rather than people trying to build up walls and protect the city or build up the church, instead you are working with these various robots, on this ship, Black Angel, and flying through space and dealing with the various things that you must deal with. So you are transporting the genetic heritage of humanity and then running these bots out to kind of manage these different tasks. It has some of the same mechanics that you know from Toi, buying each other's stuff, primarily among it. But in this case, like when somebody does buy some of your stuff, you get compensated to the degree that it's often beneficial. You can only lock in so much, but you can lock in some of it. And the artwork here is, it's one of the first times that I saw an Eno Tool design artwork wise, where I was like, it really struck me. He could like, oh, he could do sci-fi, like
purple, yeah,
and bright, mm-hmm, and beautiful and brilliant looking. So I really enjoy kind of, it's not a programming game, but it does have like that sense of like, you need to plan out all your actions pretty effectively. Or you can have a bad time, mechanically. Like first time I played it with a group, one person scored like 9 points.
Oh no.
Not great. Like you can do very poorly if you don't plan well.
Yes.
Because suddenly you have no bots and you can't take any actions. And you have to take like 3 rounds to get back your actions because you were not efficient with them. Because the bots go away. You have to have a constant supply of them coming in. It's unique. It's clever. It's my favorite version of this mechanic, even if generally people like Toi better. I think it just does more interesting things in a broader sense, even if it's a little more opaque and a little tougher to learn. But yeah, Black Angel is great. It's one of the few games that I ran to get at Gen Con,
mm-hmm,
that I still have and play regularly. There's like 2 or 3 of them.
Wow.
Which tells me to stop doing that. So, but this is definitely up there still, Black Angel.
This is a game that, like you mentioned, because of the Eno Tool artwork, because of the space theme, was, for me, highly anticipated. I did not like Toi. We've talked about this on the podcast, yeah, many times. Yeah. Not a fan. I was hoping that this was going to be the game. Now, that being said, I've never played it.
Ah.
And the reason why is the people in my group who had this game played it and just could not wrap their brain around it. And I don't know if it was the rule book. I mean, they're very smart people at the table. And I think they got it to the table twice. And it just, it wasn't that they disliked it. It was just like the rules or the concept, just something wasn't flowing with them. And it just never came out again.
It's a weird combination of abstraction and theme. Like, sure. I don't even know how to describe it, but I had a similar experience where certain people at the table are like, what am I supposed to be doing? How do I make this work?
Sure.
And I'm like, I don't know. Because we're playing the same game and I got it and you don't. I don't know where the gap is. I don't recall the rule book being particularly bad, but I'm sure it was like the TWA rule book isn't good either. Sure. So I'm sure it's partly that. But yeah, it is definitely an opaque rule set for sure.
And again, for the number of people who love TWA, I'm sure it's a good game. It's just, it does not connect with me. And again, that might be similar to their experience. I still do want to play this because I have not. And I'm hoping very good things of it. So maybe in the future. All right. For me, we're going old school again, because I guess that's where we're keeping it. Kalamala from 2017. Recently got a graphical update thanks to Ian O'Toole and Harold Leske. And now this beautiful box set. I think it was on Kickstarter. I already have the original version, so I didn't pick it up. But again, it's Ian O'Toole, man. No. Definitely always want the Ian O'Toole version of the thing. So this is about the guild of cloth finishers and cloth merchants in Florence, and how, again, Italy is a centerpiece of so many different artistic crafting creations throughout. And one of the most well-known is their woolen cloth trade. And your job here, as a typical kind of Euro game is you're placing your merchants, your assistants, your trusted employees out onto the board to conduct a number of different activities that will benefit your designs and, you know, trading and merchants and all of that kind of, you know, fun city stuff. But when you place them out onto the board, they're doing two actions. So it's not just a typical worker placement where they go down to one spot. They're actually, based on where you place them into the town center, they'll be able to benefit off two actions. Everyone's going to be able to do this. Eventually, their work becomes so well known and renowned that they actually move up to the city council. And city council has its own scoring that goes on. And there's also architectural craftsmanship that's happening at the same time, and building a number of beautiful buildings, cathedrals throughout, decorations and such. It's the mechanic is so smart and simple, and it builds throughout, and trading all of these different fabrics. It's just such an interesting game. And what I really enjoyed most about it was on the board itself, you're going to see throughout the game that there's going to be 15 different scoring periods. Those are kind of randomly placed out, so you can build towards that. And I always find that really fun when a game sets you up to not build on rails necessarily, but have opportunities to score points throughout the game. Like, you could skip a couple of those kind of scoring opportunities because you're not going to be able to do everything, but everything is available for you to do. And I love a game that gives you availability. It's not a point salad necessarily, but it has a lot of really great opportunities to build your own particular engines and be able to specialize, but also touch a little bit of everything throughout the game. So that's Kalamala.
Yeah, I love this designer. Like, this game didn't click for me quite as much as some of the other games. Like, I have, I think, two games on my overall top 100, including one last week we talked about, Merv, from Fabio Lupiano.
Yes.
Kalamala, though, like, it really, like, it's almost... It was kind of that cult hit for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I held onto a copy for a while, and I bring it to game night pretty frequently because people are like, oh, that you have Kalamala, right?
Let me
check that out. I mean, since the Kickstarter, I think more people have it, know about it. But
but
it's great. It's a great little game. Like, it's so clever in what it can do in just an hour, which is always what I love about its work.
Absolutely. It's not a super big crunchy game. It's just a good, enjoyable sit down, enjoy with a couple of people at the table. But it offers a lot of opportunities. And again, surprising for that. And Fabiano's amazing.
Yeah. All right. Next up for me, my number 78 game, a game that has been on my list for a long, pretty much since it came out. I'm pretty sure it made the list that first time we talked about it. And then it's First Class All Aboard the Orient Express. This is designed by Helmut Ohly, who designed Russian Railroads, another one of my favorites, and a whole bunch of 18XX games. One of them I got in recently, 1848 Australia. I haven't played yet. I need to do that. So this is a man who knows his train.
He does.
And this is, I'm pretty sure, the lightest train game he's made, except maybe Trombone, which is like a little two-player only thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this one came from, in the US, Z-Man Games, which means it's hard to find because they printed what they printed and they haven't reprinted it since. And it is a card game. So if it's like, take what you know of Russian Railroads, turn it into a card game, and you are trying to quite literally build out your train. So you have on one side kind of the route that you're taking. You're building out the cards in that direction so you can move along that route and get bonuses in that way. And on the other side, you have the trains themselves, which have different cars on them. And then you are trying to increase the value of those cars throughout the game. So start with zeros, maybe work your way up to sevens and 12s and whatever. You get points based on that. Mechanically speaking, the game, it's just so concise. It's the best way I can think of it. Like, everything makes sense. It has, like, all the mechanics that you know and love of just, like, a basic set collection type of tableau-building Euro game. But everything makes sense in the context of what you're doing, right? Visibly, you are building trains. Visibly, you are moving the conductor down that train line. And it, you can see it, and you can feel it, and it's fun. And people are like, oh, look at, you know, at the end of the game, somebody could walk by the table and be like, oh, you're building trains, right?
Yeah.
And it feels like that. Yeah. It's on top of that, the game comes with multiple modules. So you could play the game just basic, whatever, or you could play the literal Murder on the Orient Express module, where you're trying to solve the murder, right? I think they released a couple modules later down the road as, like, promos and single, like, small expansions, but they never really did, like, a full expansion, despite there being room in the box for more. Mm-hmm. I always wish they had. Don't think it did as well as they wanted. But First Class All Aboard the Orient Express, it's a fun theme. It's a fantastic designer. It's trains, if you love some trains and you just want a simple card game. It's up there. It's one of the best at this thing that it does. I wish it would come back. I think there's a lot of room here to grow and build and have new and fun mechanics, and they just need to kind of revisit that.
Well, there's a lot I have to say about this because it's a little bit higher on my list.
All right. We'll come back later.
All right. My number 70 is Eclipse, the Second Dawn for the Galaxy. That came out in 2020. First edition is just fine. Second edition is, I would say, a lot cleaner as far as the production. Obviously streamlined as far as dealing with the expansions and how it comes together. So I'm going for this edition of the game. I got a chance to play it. Anthony, I got a chance to play this a couple of times. Really enjoyed the original, loved the second edition. And it is somewhat your 4X epic space odyssey game. And it's always been in the shadow of TI4. So it typically has not gotten the renown that it deserves. Because if TI4 wasn't in the picture, this game would be like one of the games that was out there. It's an epic space opera with all these different factions coming together. And there's such brilliant mechanics to it. And even the production, how you're able to manage all the different resources, how you're able to upgrade your ships with all these different modules that benefit you. I think beyond the gameplay, just how they manage the player boards and all the resources is just, It's brilliance. It's just straight up brilliance. And it's just a wonderful game. You don't get tired of it. Again, because of the different factions that come into play and how the different systems open up to you. But you can play this again and again and again. And it's a lot faster and easier to get to the table than TI4. But still a brilliant game that, if you have not played it, please take a chance. Eclipse, the second edition.
All right. As you said about First Class, this one is higher on my list. So I'll be swinging back to this in a future week.
Plot twist.
All right. Next up for me, number 77. This is one of my favorite worker placement games, and the only reason it has dropped this low is because I, for whatever reason, struggle to get this to the table as much. I think the theme puts people off a little. That's the Manhattan Project Energy Empire. So this is designed by Tom Jolly and Luke Laurie. Luke Laurie, one of my favorite designers. And this is a game that has very little to do with the Manhattan Project, the original game in the series, other than the theming. Like, it uses the same little meeples. It has the same type of artwork. It comes from Minion Games. They were trying to build out a little world. But yep. The game itself is about building an energy empire, right? So you are building up different types of energy production, which involves you collecting different types of dice. And then those dice represent the type of energy you can produce. And the dirtier the energy, the more pollution it might produce, and the riskier it might be. Cleaner energy doesn't produce as much, but you don't. The risk-reward ratio isn't there for that either. There's a lot of things you can try to complete. There's tableau you can build out to have additional abilities and upgrades and things you can do. So it is worker placement, but it has all these other elements around it, right? It has the push your luck of the dice rolls. It has the event deck that comes out, and it can do bad things to everybody because there's a global events, like the government getting involved and everything. And then the tableau itself that you're trying to build out, and then your own personal player board where you're placing potential pollution and trying to manage that. So it turns what is a relatively simple mechanic into a much more complex puzzle. And as a result, it doesn't feel like just a worker placement game. It feels like it's doing all these things, and they all come together really well to tell a story about the production of energy and the impact it can have, how people interact with those systems. It's not just like build the best energy company and get money and produce energy for your country. Right. It's not Power Grid. It's actually commenting on the production of energy and what that looks like to the world and to the governments in the world and the people who live there and how they have to interact with that. I really love it for that. So I was able to recently track down a copy of the expansion for this, which famously kind of disappeared. Wow. It was on Kickstarter and it just didn't get. They eventually got it pushed out, but it happened after the owner of Minion Games had passed. And it was just really difficult to find a copy. So I did pay a little bit of a premium, but I got a copy of that. I was very happy about that. So I'm hoping to get that to the table more in the future. But yeah, the Manhattan Project Energy Empire, one of my favorite worker placement games, one of my favorite just energy anythings, like economic style game. It does a great job with that.
This is definitely higher on my list. I don't have the expansion. We have to play this now.
I know.
Let's do it now.
It was one of those things like somehow I was like, how did I miss this Kickstarter? I would have backed this in 2 seconds. I've 100%. Had this game since it came out. How did I 100%. Miss it? Like they must not have promoted it at all. And they didn't have that many backers. So that speaks to that. But I did track it down. We will play it.
I'm kind of upset about that now. Really, really, really kind of upset about that now. Because like you said, there wouldn't even be a question about that.
Right.
But I will have an opportunity to rage about that on a later episode. All right. So going from Energy Empire, I guess, to something a little different, Coimbra from 2018. This is all about the 15th and 16th century in Portugal. And they're leading the age of discovery out there in the world. And Coimbra is serving as the cultural center of the country of Portugal. And they have their monasteries and they have their universities and they have influential citizens from around the world that are coming to attend and learn. And it's a wondrous, beautiful game. This is from Brazzini and Gili again. And I was very excited to get this table. This was one of my hotly anticipated games. I think I bought this at the convention, played this immediately as soon as I could. Color, graphic design, off the charts, of course. Really just lovely up and down from Chris Quilliams. And what I really enjoyed most about that was how the dice were utilized, because the color and the pip both came into play throughout the game as far as selecting people to activate in your particular area, but also special abilities that go throughout, movement, tracks. Again, a brilliant, beautiful, colorful game with a lot of just value throughout, as far as like what you do early on does benefit you throughout, but it offers a lot of flexibilities as far as point scoring is concerned that you never really feel truly out of the game. So a wonderful, beautiful experience. Coimbra back in 2018.
All right. It's not higher on my list anymore, but it was on my list last time and it just barely eked its way off. I love this game. I was in that line with you. I've also bought this at Origins when they first opened. And I remember because we were both like, this better be worth $70.
That's right.
That was one of the first like baseline midweight Euros. It was $70 off the line. And you're like, really?
They were charging. That company was really high.
Yeah, they always were. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turned out it was great. So we were both very happy with that.
Yes, but, very much so.
It's very clever. I love the artwork of it, too. And it was like one of those things, like when the follow-up to it came out, Alma Mater, it looks kind of similar. It has a similar vibe. And I was like, oh, it's going to be great. And it didn't quite live up to the same.
I know. Was that funny?
Because Coimbra, it's so unique in what it's doing. But yeah, great game.
Connection is a healthy and essential aspect of our daily lives. From a warm hug after a hard day to kind words just when we need them. These gentle moments give us an understanding of life's true meaning. But when the ability to connect is interrupted by the hustle of daily life and to-do lists pile up next to the worry of who needs school supplies, sometimes making decisions about our health and the well-being of our loved ones can take a back seat. When it comes to those we care for, vaccines are one of the greatest public health success stories. And along with other measures, are one way to help prevent certain diseases. At Merck, we envision communities where families, healthcare providers, local organizations, and advocates work together. Health equity happens when every person, regardless of age and ethnicity, in every community, has fair access to healthcare, including the vaccines they need. For more information, please visit whyvaccines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alrighty, number 76 on my end. This one came out in 2020, but it's a little bit older than that because this is Albin Viard, and he remakes and redesigns and rebuilds his games every few decades or few years. This is Clinic Deluxe. It's based on Clinic, which came out in 2014, and it is a significantly upgraded version of that game. So, Albin Viard's games started coming out like about 15 years ago, and they were very minimal production. They didn't have a lot going on. They were, I don't know if they were like locally made or handmade or whatever they were, but not a lot there. I had a copy of Small City at one point. I have a copy of Town Center. Very bare bones basics game. Clinic Deluxe was the first time he went to Kickstarter, and he's like, all right, let's do the best version of this we can. I got Ian O'Toole on board. He's going to do all the artwork. It's going to look great. We got slip covers, we got expansions everywhere, we got fancy meeples, and all of that is great. The production is solid on this game across the board, and along with the 17 expansions he's released since. Man can't stop. So many expansions for this game. But the core game, which is what I've played the most by far, I played a few expansions, but not that many of them, despite buying them all because I'm a crazy person, is a logistics puzzle, right? You're building out the hospital, and so you have the different floors that you're trying to manage. You're trying to manage things like parking. Like, do you have enough space for these cars that are coming in to represent the patients that are in the hospital? You're trying to make sure that the patients have space to go and where they can go and what they're going to interact with. And you need to have things to support them. You have the floors interacting with each other. So like, if you want to build on the second floor, you need to have stuff below it on the first floor, obviously. So it's a spatial puzzle, which most of his games are, on top of a logistics puzzle. And then occasionally, depending on what mechanics you throw in there from expansions, it could be anything else. It could be a zombie outbreak, right? Or you could be trying to manage fire hydrants. Or you could have a whole separate parking mini game going on the side. So it's the core game is so interesting and fascinating in how it forces you to think about what every decision you make is going to impact your future decisions, right? You're going down a path. It can't diverge back. You can't like loop back on yourself. You really have to keep going in that direction. So you're like, is this the direction I want to go? Is this the tile I want to take with this action right now? My turn. I have these options. This is the one I want. And so that can create a little bit of analysis paralysis for sure. But it also creates a really satisfying conclusion as you kind of build out your hospital and manage it. It can also be really frustrating if you mess it up. But to me, that's like the best Euro games is the ones where you're really mad at the end, not because the game was unfair, but because you made the wrong decisions. So there you go. Clinic Deluxe Edition. Just the base game. I can't speak to all the expansions. There's like 4,000 of them at this point.
So you mean 69 expansions?
Yeah. Jeez. That's where I drew the line. I was like, thanks for jumping the shark. I can be done now. I have the 5. I'm good.
Same.
The wait listing on Board Game Geek is a 4. I think it's a little high. I think it's just because there's so much going on.
There is
a lot of bits. Mm-hmm. The core mechanics are not actually that complicated, and the game's not that long. It's just how you layer things on.
The spatial placement is challenging for a lot of people.
That's true. That's fair. I think I have played with several people who really struggle, just like very smart people who do very well at games.
Yeah.
Like I cannot wrap my brain around keeping track of 3 different dimensions of building at the same time.
And zombies for some reason.
And zombies, yeah. That makes it just that much easier.
Well, I could say more, and I will at a later point.
Oh man, we're on a roll this week.
All right. Next up is my number 76 game, Anthony's previous number one game of all time, Agricola Revised Edition for 2016.
Oh wait, hold up. This is way higher on my list. You gotta wait. I'm just kidding.
No, it's not. It's not. I didn't think so. We joke because Agricola from Uwe Rosenberg and Clemens Franz, as far as the artwork, famous artwork. His artwork is everywhere when Uwe Rosenberg is. Where do I begin? What can I say new about Agricola that I haven't said so many times before? Let's go with the eye. It's misery farming, right?
Yeah, like it is.
You are growing up, you're growing a family in the 17th century, and you are dealing with all the challenges and the issues that come along with, having a small farm, which primarily includes feeding your family, which way back in the day when I first played this was like, what? I've played plenty of worker placement games and you never had to feed them? And you have to feed people? Yes. And you can also give, you can have babies. And that was a thing that you could do too. But you have to have room to have babies. So like, it was such a, especially at the time, such an innovative idea of incorporating real life, real world situations and mechanics that you had to deal with. What really puts this over the top as far as a tabletop game is concerned is the truly thematic gameplay. In order to grow your crops, you have to plow the fields, plant the seeds, harvest the vegetables. And then if you want to make food, I mean, obviously you can eat the vegetables straight, but if you really want to make food to serve the whole family, then you have to bake the bread, for example, right? There's multiple steps that you have to take in order to serve your family and to score additional victory points by overproducing enough to sell to the markets, so to speak. Now, there is a deck of cards. Actually, there's multiple deck of cards that come into play in this game. And there is a drafting mechanic. Now, you can play the way where you just get random cards, but that really honestly never really works well to anybody. And there's a family edition where you don't play with the cards at all. But primarily, the game is very much about the different decks of cards that can come into play that really open the game up. Gives you different occupations, gives you different specialties that you can utilize, gives you different equipment to benefit your farm. And it really creates a little difference between your gameplay and what you can do versus what other people can do at the table. So playing those cards and knowing those cards are challenging for new players. And with the number of decks that are out there now, it's both challenging but also exciting because it really adds a lot to the gameplay. So Agricola, the revised edition, there's many editions out there. There was recently a super crazy deluxe edition, but the revised edition is more than enough. And that came out in 2016, and I still love it to this day.
It did come out in 2016. Mm-hmm. That's true. I could say that about that game.
Bold statement, buddy. Bold statement.
Bold statement.
You could also say Animeeples, because that was the thing that came out with Agricola.
That's true. I do love Animeeples, and now they're in all those games.
So. I know. But they weren't back in the day.
I remember you had to buy them separately. Until you
know. They used to be, everything was a disc and a cube.
Yeah. I can't imagine playing any of those games with discs and cubes.
I'm telling you.
Alrighty. Number 75 for me, and you can tell how much I like this game because I had something else here in the spreadsheet, and I was like, I don't think that's right. I think that's the wrong thing. I think I changed that at some point.
Are you saying it both is and isn't?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Your number 75?
It was and was not on my list. Because
that's right.
When I did a Control F, it was not on the list. I'm like, that's not right, because this game is definitely on my list. It's Cat in the Box, Deluxe Edition. This is a trick-taking game. So the original version of this came out many, many years ago in Japan, and Bezier Games brought it to the U.S. with Cat in the Box as a deluxe edition. Just a fancy inset board, get cool little artwork on all the cats. And the reason I love this game in particular so much is because it's almost like a social experiment. And at the end of the day, it's just a trick-taking game, right? But when you remove all the suits, especially the first round or two you play with people, it's fun to watch how they react to that, because it doesn't actually change the game, but it forces you to think a little more abstract about what you're doing, right? So you have hands of cards. They're all the same suit because it's all just that black cat in the box that may or may not be red or blue or green or yellow. And so you're deciding what color any one card is going to be. And then you place a cube onto location on the main board saying, I have played the red two, right? But you have to think about, like, okay, what might other people have? Not necessarily the colors, because everybody has the same cards, but the numbers, and then what's already used in those numbers, and then ultimately, which suit can I abandon by saying I don't have it? Because you can't then later have it. That would be a paradox. So you have to, you're like, okay, you played a green three. I'm going to jump to the Trump suit and say I have a red four, so I could win this hand. But now I'm just saying I have no green. Right? Because I didn't play any green, so I changed suits. And so that stuff, it like really breaks people's brains trying to think about, like, okay, well, when can I do this and how can I do this? And inevitably somebody always runs out of suits they can play by like the fourth or fifth card of a hand early in the game and goes to Paradox. And then Paradox, obviously, you're just going to lose points. So I ultimately, at the end of the day, I love trick-taking games that allow me to play my own little game and solve my own little puzzle with the hands that I'm playing, regardless of whether I win suits. It has a bid mechanic. You say how many hands you think you're going to win. I also love that. And I can work towards something regardless of the quality of my hand. It's great. It's cute. I didn't get the mega version because that seemed silly and unnecessary, but Cat in the Box Deluxe Edition is a fantastic little game that just keeps hitting the table because it's a fun thing to show people, especially people who do not play games. It's just like, you want to see something weird and cool? How about this weird little Paradox card game? So, there you go.
It's a great game. It didn't make the list, but it was certainly up there. And I play a lot of this, and I play even on Board Game Arena. Mm. And I don't know. Like, there's been a renaissance with trick-taking games recently. And this seems to be the one that it's kind of won out as far as what hits the table. And it's not just because it's cute and adorable, because it is certainly cute and adorable, but
yeah,
it's very smart, as you mentioned, with pulling the colors off, but also like the wagering that goes along with it and the spatial element of like trying to get certain numbers together. So I don't know, like it's strength, but it's also its weakness at the same time, because it's not a pure trick taking game. So it's both at the same time, which again, not intentional. It's really not intentional.
Or fun. Maybe it is.
Maybe it is. We don't know. All right. For me, again, small little tiny card game that I enjoyed. I was so hotly anticipated for this that when we got to Gen Con and we got there early, running throughout the convention center to get this little tiny nothing of a box game that must have been like $15 at the time, and just waiting at the booth, the whole hour expiring of VIP time where I could have went anywhere and spoke to anyone, but I wanted this game. I wanted to be able to review this game. I was so excited about it. This is Castles of Burgundy, the card game. You probably all know Castles of Burgundy, but you may not know that there was a card game version of this out there. And it is, of course, our good friend Stefan Feld, but it is a small box game, small cards. And instead of the dice rolling, the cards themselves have dice. So again, what we're bringing into the game is all the interesting mechanics that go along with Castles of Burgundy. Everything is still true as far as what the particular locations do. But you now, I guess, bring it down to like a point where all of those actions and the dice and their abilities are now being able to utilize in a multi-use card game. And as I spoke about this before, I love multi-use card games. I love the idea that each card has a number of different opportunities to do different things with. So it's fun. It's fast. It gets you the Castle Burgundy fix in a very short amount of time. So Castles of Burgundy, the card game, way back 2016.
Great little game. Yeah, this was on my list for a long time. It kind of fell off this year. I didn't really even realize it until I checked last week. And I'm not unhappy about that. I do play the new one a fair bit, but it's still fantastic. Like, it's one of those things, like, I have this and the dice game kind of slammed into the same little box, the tuck box, and they're just fun to bring with you, because the card game does take up more space than you think it should for a card game, but it's still very portable, which is great.
Especially compared to your new super deluxe version of Castle's
Burgundy. Right, now I have, like, the least portable version of this game. Like, I love it. It's higher on my list, I guess, but I don't know.
I have this box with these little tiny cards that it could do a lot of things, or this super giant deluxe acrylic version. Which one do you want to play, guys?
I know. I got in two games this week that are both just enormous, stupid boxes. I'm like, what am I doing? It's just too big.
You're building an extension on your house is what you're going to be doing.
I'm going to build them with the games. They're going to be wall pieces. All right. Next up, we have a game that I used to think was in a big box. Number 74, Fields of Arl from 2014.
Oh, yeah.
This is Uwe Rosenberg taking his 1-2 player formula, which he had in like Agricola, All Things Big and Small, and Le Havre Duel, or Inland Port, I think I called it. And he's like, let's do that, but in a giant box, like Agricola size, but even bigger. And now we have the ultimate 1-2 player worker placement game. Which I would still argue it is, even now. Now, with the expansion, Tea and Trade, you can play up to three people. I don't love that. It makes the game a little longer, and I don't think the expansion adds too much. It adds like a pick-up and deliver mechanism, which is kind of cool, but I don't know. I like the base game a lot the way it is. This is the first one, I think, that really did the like sprawling sandbox mode. Like, Caverna has this a little, but it's programmed a little. This is like the proto Feast for Odin worker placement board, where you have just so many options. And the difference here is you have like the two different seasons to choose from. So, or the different times of day. So you're not always able to choose from all of those options, but there are a lot of options.
Sure.
So it is one of those games that where you don't want too many people around the table, because otherwise you're just staring at it forever. which we'll get to a game later that I want to talk about that does that. So it's relaxed. It's simple. The things you're doing are very simple. You have like a personal player board. You're removing the thing you do in Uwe Rosenberg games. You remove the detritus, the stuff, and then you build on top of it. And it's all seasonal based, and it's just very cozy. Just like it reminds me of playing like a video game like Stardew Valley. It's a very cozy thing. You're just building these things out. There's not like, you're not going on epic quests. you got to feed people, but you're not going to like suddenly all die in the winter, like in Agricola or other games. There's a lot of options to choose from, so you can kind of take a different path every time. And, you know, it's great as a solo experience, not significantly different than his other ones, but I really like it as a two-player game because it has like that dueling mechanism to it. but a little bit more bite than one of those smaller dueling games, which he's made a bunch of. But this is like a couple hours long. So Fields of Arl, great game. Don't necessarily need the expansion, but can't go wrong if you just want more of it. Yeah, it's like at least my third, maybe fourth Rosenberg game on this list so far.
I'm glad you put, you picked this one out, because I think this is more than any of his other farming kind of games gets lost. I think if you've asked people name all the Rosenberg games that they know, this one always gets forgotten. It's like the middle child.
It's weird. Yeah. It came out the year after Caverna and like a year, year and a half before Fields or Feast for Odin.
That's what I'm saying.
Like disappears.
Yeah, 100%. Those are two big games, like epic, massive, wondrous games. And then they're like, hey, you remember me? Like, aw, you're there. You exist, right? You're a thing.
This is like one of those games when you look at the top 100 on BoardGameGeek, you're like, really? But it definitely deserves to be there. So, yeah, check it out.
All right. Let's get some fun stuff out here. We went small. Let's go big. My number 74. Through the Ages, A New Story of Civilization.
That's big.
Back in 2015. Obviously, this is the second edition re-implementation from Through the Ages, A Story of Civilization. This is the better version of it. This is a streamlined version of it. Beautiful artwork, beautiful game design. Vlado Shevadel, just amazing. It is, a lot of people will say, I don't know, like, it is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Civilization games of all time that's ever been out there. There's an app. App is also very good. I highly recommend the app, because this game takes a lot of table space up. And it's a beautiful, streamlined journey through all the different ages of civilization, with the military factions, with all the different leaders, and how thematically they play out, and then utilizing resources, but also managing population and dealing with the population, allowing you to explore new islands and gain new resources, but at the same time dealing with war that often happens, and people kind of conflict with each other. And again, especially back in the day, like, Euro games were not known for their conflict. And to have a civilization game that has such a thoughtful military war kind of mechanic that benefits off a lot of different things. You know, what era of civilization is your military like? What form of government do you have? What is the benefits of that particular leader? Are they a military strategist or not? And a lot of that sometimes you can mostly avoid. The cards allow you to do a lot of different things, and science is especially handy, and building all the different wonders. Obviously, it breaks, you know, history, so to speak. But there's just so much goodness to it. And each of the cards just gives you so many different ways to play. So enjoyable. A wondrous game from CGE. And a really a brilliant expansion. If you haven't played the expansion with the new leaders, I highly recommend that as well. Through the Ages, A New Story of Civilization. Came out in 2015 and still just kicking so much butt these days. I mean, still as good as ever.
Wonderful, wonderful game. We'll talk about it some more soon.
Whoa. That seems like a hint of sorts. A foreshadowing, yeah. Even.
Foreshadowing of what's happening in some week in the future. all right. Next up for me is a game that I thought I would hate. And
that's a good way to start.
I really did. I thought I would hate this game. And I avoided it. I think you reviewed it at one point, and you're like, it's great. And I was like, nah, it looks bad.
I think this is the game. This is it. This is, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I remember having this conversation. You're like, no, you should try it. You'll like it. I'm like, nah, I don't think I will. This is Martin Wallace's Australia.
With a Z.
2018. With a Z. With the big old Z in the middle there.
Because reasons.
Yeah. I don't know what the Z stands for, because it's not Cthulhu. But you got to make it weird. That's how you make it weird.
Yeah.
So this is a game about alternate reality in the 30s, and you have Cthulhu and all his buddies invading Australia, and you are, I don't know what, fighting them off? Defending them? I don't know what you're doing. But it's this, like, you look at the map at first, you're like, oh, okay, it's got like a like a, almost a wargamey kind of look to it.
Mm-hmm.
All these different tiles and discs and cubes all over the map. And you have all this hidden information out there and you're moving around, you're trying to interact with it. And at the end of the day, what the game actually is, it's this very clever puzzle where you're trying to make sure you have what you need and at the same time interact with the right spaces to generate points for yourself. And then also somehow communally dealing with these threats as they come up, because you could all just lose, despite the fact that the game does still have a winner. It's not cooperative.
No.
And I love games who find a, that find a way to do this, because so few pull it off of like, there's a common threat. There's a bad thing that affects everybody. Put yourself in a position where it affects someone else more than you, right? Put yourself in a position where you're going to generate a lot of points and still be able to deal with the threat while somebody else cannot generate those points, not deal with the threat. And it's such a clever way of doing that. And it has like those little things that you know Martin Wallace for, right? Like there's route building, right? There's you're dealing with the grid, you're dealing with a map. Like this is a guy who likes his train games and he likes his card-based games. But at the end of the day, it's doing so much unique and creative things within this space that like the only other game I can think of is from him that is as weird as this is his other Cthulhu game, A Study in Emerald, which might be on my list if I could ever find a copy for less than like $300.
Sure.
Like I haven't played that game in 10 years, but I remember loving it. So it's somehow makes an adventure game, which I don't generally like, and it makes a Cthulhu game, which I almost never like. And it combines those with enough Euro mechanics to make it just like a fascinating puzzle of an experience. And it's great. Expansions are good too, but just by itself, Australia. It's I thought I'd hate it for all those reasons and above. And then Chris, I didn't listen to you. And then a friend brought it over and made me play it. And I was like, oh, this is good.
Thanks, man. Thanks a lot. I do well, do a podcast on board games.
You I know? Wasn't going to go buy it, but if someone brings it to me, I'll play it. If you'd brought it down here, I would have played it.
Jeez. It's a Frankenstein of other games and other themes.
It is.
And don't forget the military. It's a military game, too. It's a war game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All these things. How did he do that?
I don't know. I don't know. Again, when someone was like suggested this, I'm like, oh, no. I mean, for some, like for all the reasons that are included in that game, but I will say more at a later date.
Ooh, we are on a roll this week.
I'm telling you, got a lot of matches. If you're keeping track, that's a lot for this episode.
Yeah, right. It's like half of them.
All right. My number 73 for me is in some ways a little bit of a throwback, just because back in the day, this was so revolutionary. As far as a game was concerned, I still remember to this day, I think it was Miniature Market or one of the other websites, Cool Stuff, or just even online on eBay at the time. I not only needed to purchase this game after playing it, but I needed to purchase every expansion that was ever out for this game, and was making I was making promises that my wallet could not keep.
Yeah.
This is The Lord of the Rings, the card game from 2011. This is the LCG about Tolkien's Middle Earth. And this is the wondrous game about, playing all the different worlds and different journeys in Middle Earth, J.R.R. Tolkien, utilizing all of the different famous characters that we've come to love. In the books, in the movies, and not necessarily in the TV shows, but they're okay. It's fine. I don't know. Let's move on. So this was a living card game above and beyond. It took some of the great elements from CCGs and put it in something that you could play again and again. And you can play with other players or you can play solo. And the artwork is fantastic. The gameplay is fantastic. Designer Nate French is fantastic. All the artists that here are wonderful. What a beautiful, wondrous game to get to the table. Lord of the Rings, their card game.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but I did want to just comment because I do think it's funny you talked about trying to find all the expansions. I was 100% on this track for a long, long time because they don't reprint enough of these stupid things.
Nope.
Thankfully, they started doing the revised edition, but when they did the revised edition, it's just like, we're going to take from this cycle and then this one over here and now this one over here. It's so random.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know which of these I already have. And then I, at least once or twice, I bought something I already have. And I'm like, gosh, darn it. Which I guess is why they did that.
Yes.
But I will also say, last thing before I talk about it later, you can play through the movie or the book. Like they have those sets, which is great. And those are available now. So worth checking.
Absolutely.
All right. Next up for me at 72 is, so this always annoys me, but the game I have is Texas Showdown. It is a trick-taking game from 2015.
Okay.
If you're looking for it now, it's been renamed to Seas of Strife.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, because whatever.
That's going to make it easier to find.
It's boats now instead of, like, cowboy stuff. I'm like, who is the cowboy stuff hurting? It's not, there's nothing inherently racist or problematic in that game. It was just, like, cacti and wheels and hats. I'm like, sure. What is wrong with this game? And I don't care about the theme. It's just when I type in Texas Showdown on the website, on Board Game Geek, I can't find it.
That's correct.
They literally changed the name. So it's a trick-taking game in which there are multiple different suits, but they count up. So it's a trick-taking game and a ladder game. And that creates a lot of interesting situations where, like, the top of the top, you might have the wheels, which there are five of, between 61 and 65. If somebody plays a 64, they're probably going to win that unless somebody accidentally plays a higher card or if they have to play the 65. So you're trying to keep track of the different suits at different levels. And it's really tricky in that sense because you have like basically five or six different chunks of trick taking to keep track of. And then the ladder element on top of that, plus you're bidding and you're trying to get rid of all your cards. So it's a very clever trick-taking game. It's very quick. It's one we played over and over again, multiple rounds, and I really enjoyed it. I still have my copy. I don't know if you can get the Texas Showdown version. I don't think it matters. Again, Seas of Strife is the same game. But it's just a fun... There's always something to do within the context of the game. You're never like stuck with a bad hand, because no matter what cards you have, you can work around them because there are all those different suits to work with. So... Texas Showdown. I refuse to call it the other thing.
You're going to hold to it, huh?
Yeah, I'm holding it.
All right.
It's what I have. It's what's on the box.
It's true. All right. My number 72, again, is, again, not a major throwback, but an original for BGA. Back in the day of Mirror Games, one of the best worker placement games that benefited off of Kingsburg was a game that was on Kickstarter, lots of controversy, but a fantastic game. This is Alien Frontiers that came out in 2010. And it's all about utilizing technology to, again, do some of the things that you need to do as far as like terraforming the planet, dealing with resource management, and dealing with other competitors that are trying to kind of encroach upon your space. You're building colonies on this newly discovered world. It has a lot of different resources that it provides for you throughout. And the dice roll in this game allows you to utilize different action spots on the board. There is a lot of little mini expansions, and I mean a lot. I own a couple of them, and I like the game so much I couldn't collect all of them. And I think there was a reprint of it that had some of them inside of it, but it's still a fantastic game to get to the table. A lot of fun for all players. A little more crunchy, a little more heavier than Kingsburg, but again, rolling dice, seeing what you get as far as pips, playing the actions, dealing with space. One of the major games that allowed us to do that, and a lot of fun. Alien Frontiers.
This is one I never really got a chance to play very much, but the couple times I played it, I really enjoyed it.
It's a snazzy little game, my friend.
Yeah, gotta get it out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, number 71 for me, last one this week, is a pretty new game. We just played this a couple months ago for the first time. Arcs. This is the new one from Cole Worley that shipped over the summer, which if you pay any attention to board games, you already knew that, because it's everywhere. And it is a game of galactic conquest, trade and conquest. I don't really know how you want to play it, but you have different factions. And it's space opera-ish. They call it space opera, but it's very quick in terms of how you play it, with a trick-taking element to the card play. And I say element because some people will say call it a trick-taking game. I don't think that's accurate. But the way you play the suits of your cards will determine how many actions you can take, and those actions will determine what you can accomplish on the board. And those can be things like generating resources or moving into other people's territory, attacking people, so on and so forth. The main core of the game, though, is you're declaring these different ambitions, and the ambitions will be things like having the most of this resource at the end of the round, or having the most captured ships at the end of the round. And that element, like kind of the push your luck of going all in on an ambition where the points are going to come from, but you don't necessarily get those points unless you have that at the end of the round, really creates some tension there, especially like with multiple people at the table. One person's kind of pulling away from one region and then they claim that ambition. Like, how do you respond to that? Such a fascinating experience. The game itself, once you know the rules, plays fairly quickly. And this is the base game, mind you. I haven't really played with the full campaign yet. I've pulled it out. I've kind of run through it. But I have not, like, sat down and gotten a chance to play, like, that three-arc campaign in the Bladed Reach expansion. I really want to do that. From what I've seen and what I've experienced and what people have told me, I'm like, this game will probably be higher on my list in a future year because of that expansion.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is presented here, it's just a really fun, quick, accessible. And you want the lore and leaders cards in there to kind of give you that asymmetry at the beginning of the game. But with that material, the game really, it really just, it flows very smoothly, right? It's not quite up the way like Root is, just as a base game by itself. But I really enjoy it quite a bit. It stands out a lot in terms of like, you want a space opera, but you don't want to sit here for 5-6 hours? You got Arcs.
Yeah, I'm really, I wish I had the opportunity to go into the whole campaign mode. Because that seems where the game kind of lives.
Yeah, no, it's what little I've seen, I think it's probably steps above this even. I like this a lot. I really enjoy it, mm-hmm. but it just is what it is, right? It doesn't have that emergence at the other. The
oh, sure. I do appreciate the fact that you can break the, you know, that portion of the core game off and still have a fully playable game considering all of the expansions and campaign stuff that comes along with it.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of glad they didn't sell it. Like, it's just one, because the expansion box is like 5 times the size of the base box. It's huge. It's this big jumbo, again, a big jumbo stupid box in the basement now. Whereas this is like the size of a Root box, which is great. It's accessible. It's quick, you know.
I think that's a note for publishers in the future. Like,
yeah,
if you're going to do one of these gigantic big boxes, like, we appreciate it. Like, again, this is a monkey paw situation. We asked for this. We know. It's our fault. We wanted everything in one box because having multiple expansion boxes was problematic for a lot of ways. That being said, we can't move these things to game nights. So,
I know. It's no good.
Please give us a way to actually transport these things because it's a problem, right? It's a first world problem, but it's still a problem nonetheless. All right. My final game for the list is my number 71. An original, a classic, a modern day classic. Plays with everybody. And is in box stores because it's King of Tokyo from 2011. This is the genius, the man, the mystery that is Richard Garfield, along with a large number of great artists. It is the classic kaiju movie monsters that are battling out on the table for literally King of the Mountain kind of situation. There's a couple different versions of this out there. There's King of New York, which I enjoy a great deal. I love the destructible buildings and how the military comes into play. There's King of Tokyo Dark Edition that just takes the basic edition and adds a couple of different new modules and expansions. All very good. I have not played King of Monster Island. Thematically, I think I'd like it, but I have not heard the best stuff about it. But again, King of Tokyo, the basic King of Tokyo with the expansions or the dark version or New York version. Fantastic. You're Yahtzeeing yourself to success. You're rolling a handful of great dice. You're picking up special power-ups with energy. And then you're either trying to get all the fame possible to win or trying to knock everyone else and end up as the final player. It's a player elimination game that is tremendous fun. Plays fast, plays rapid. Everyone can play this at the table. I love it. I own a lot of it. Not all of it, because again, they went a little crazy with all the monsters, which I appreciate it, but they became really expensive.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show the fact that I did love it so much that I did follow that train at least a little bit. King of Tokyo, 2011, Richard Garfield. I mean, is there anything this man can't do? Please tell me.
Apparently not. Like, yeah, we've already talked about what, at Bunny Kingdom?
I know.
The first week, and now King of Tokyo. We don't even touch on his big game.
He could just done magic and just, like, been, like, a cultural icon forever. And he's just like, yeah. No, other games. They're just like, really? And they're amazing. Games.
Yeah. Like, you can tell he's just at home tinkering. He's like, I'm bored. I'll make a game today.
And King of Tokyo is pretty huge. I mean, it's big. It's out there for such a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's very successful. Great game.
All right, everyone. There you go. Our number 80 to number 71. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. I hope that you'll stay with us for our next episode where we go through number 70, number 61. They only get better as the list goes on. Again, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll see if you all see at the table. Take care, everyone.